Hey, this is Tony Kanaan, IndyCar driver, and you're listening to PlanetIRL.com.
Position. There's no question for that. Those two had been running close to side by side at the exit of turn number two.
For the PPG Cup. Look, oh, look, here comes, here he comes, here he comes, and he gets him! Can he get him back? Can he hang on?
Does he make it? They have contact. Now returning. Oh, they stuff each other. They take each other out of the race. Neither one would give.
Who's going to win it? Oh, Harney's won it. Harney's took it. Can you believe that? Harney's took it at the finish line.
Hello and welcome to another PlanetIRL.com podcast. I'm Steph, joined again by Paul, and a little later on we have a special guest as well. We were joined this afternoon by Tony Kanaan and had the opportunity to ask him a few questions. Looking forward to hearing how that turned out. But before we get to that, Paul, let's talk about Iowa. You were there for that event this weekend, so I'm sure you have a great deal of insight to share on what that was like.
I absolutely love Iowa. Iowa gets the rap at, oh, there's nothing to do, it's a boring place, it's in the middle of nowhere, there's nothing there but corn. Let me tell you, if you're an IndyCar racing fan, put Iowa on your list as a place to go to. Yeah, there aren't a whole lot of things to do around the speedway. But keep in mind, the Saturday events there literally went from sun up, starting at 9 o'clock, to almost 10 o'clock at night. It was a full show with all of the Road to Indy series there as well. The racing is fantastic. The facility itself is excellent. I have literally sat as far down in turn four as you can, as far into turn one as you can, at the top of the grandstands and four rows from the bottom. There is no bad place to watch an event from there. It's a true bull ring to watch them drive there. A lot of people say that Iowa drives too much like the super speedways, the mile and a half tracks. They don't. Let me tell you, I sat in turn one. There was a lot of lifting, a lot of gear shifting. With the bump down in turn two, you can really see them driving the cars. It is a fantastic place to go and watch a race. And I cannot recommend Iowa enough for everyone to go to at least one time and see that race.
And I think that the prevailing opinion, even for those who weren't there this weekend, is that we haven't had as good a demonstration in a long time of the fact that the short ovals are an area where the schedule is really lacking right now. And we're going to talk about schedule a little bit later on in the podcast.
You know, short ovals a lot of times can be a little bit of follow the leader. Milwaukee, we've seen that sometimes where it's kind of processional. It's very difficult to pass. Iowa this weekend really showed if you have a good car, you can make passes.
Here's a question for you, Paul. Do you think that, because it's clear from watching the race in Iowa that the aero changes that they made last year, the addition of the push-to-pass system, these are things that made a really big difference in terms of the raceability on all of the oval tracks, but you could see those things making a difference in Iowa as well. Can we go out far enough to say that Richmond might have been dumped from the schedule prematurely?
Absolutely, I think so. I absolutely think so. Keep in mind, though, as well, Iowa is really starting to mature as a track. The first year or two that the IndyCars were there, it was very grippy, and it took no effort whatsoever to stay full throttle on the white line. Now that the track is starting to mature a little bit and lose a little bit of that grip, it just races better. Richmond is a mature track that had some of that. It was just a very difficult track for the guys to drive on because there was really no separation in speed. And we saw that last year. I think it was Scott Dixon leading, trying to lap Ed Carpenter, and it took him something like 20 laps to make that pass on lapping a car because there was just really no separation in the speed. You didn't get the difference in performance that you really need between the leaders and the back markers. I think if they would have gone back to Richmond this year with the new aero package, with the push to pass, and maybe some alterations on the Firestone Firehawks, I think we could have seen Richmond really, really put on another good show like we'd seen many times in the past. So absolutely, I think it was premature. I think it was, let's be honest, Richmond is another International Speedway Corporation, ISC track. They have two NASCAR dates. They have one in traditionally the weekend before Mother's Day and then in September. which means the summer should be good for them. But that crowd, some people said it was getting slightly larger, but it really wasn't taking off. And I thought it personally looked like it was kind of contracting. Was that due to the processional nature of the event? I don't know. But I certainly think if they went back there this year, they would see a far different event than what they saw last year. And it is really too bad that they so quickly gave it the axe.
Okay, so let's talk about the race itself from this weekend, though. The primary thing that stood out in my mind, and for a lot of people, other than the fact that the race was just fantastic to watch in person and on television, with passing left and right, up and down, was two of three KV cars, again, didn't make it through this week, and one of them was just a pretty blatant rookie mistake by Takuma Sato. Had a funny moment on Twitter this week, actually, where the gentleman who runs the account, and he's on it, tweeted a quote that said, "You're always fastest right before you hit the wall," and it just seemed terribly appropriate for Takuma Sato's situation this weekend. He was up to third, he was running very strongly, and then got up into the marbles, and that was the end of it. We've seen that happen so many times, but far too many times to KV this year.
Yeah, he was running a very strong third, and just before the accident, he had passed Scott Dixon, and I forget which Penske driver it was. It may have been Elio at the time, I just don't recall. But, I mean, he passed them like they were standing still. It wasn't a, "I'm going to dive bomb you and you'll let me by." I mean, he just blew by them. He really had it going. And then, like you said, just a pure rookie mistake. He drove right up behind Alex, lost his front end, and into the wall. I've heard some people say that Alex was involved with that, but
it was all by himself to me.
I saw nothing that Alex Lloyd did inappropriate in that exchange. He just drove his line like he had been, and Sato just lost it. He just pushed right up into the wall. It is important to note that Marias, in this case, had no responsibility in this accident whatsoever.
Absolutely, but that doesn't mean that the tab for KV Racing is any less.
No, exactly. And you know, there, even when you don't have any control over the accident, you still put yourself in that position, either by qualifying or by, you know, something else going on in the race. But yeah, certainly this was not his fault, just like it wasn't his fault at St. Pete. But, you know, unfortunately, the crash damage payments come out of the same ledger. And that's two more heavily crashed cars for KV this week, which brings my unofficial tally up to 16 now. It's a lot of damaged race cars.
It is, and let's hope that the checks keep getting written, because it would be a shame to see that team lose any support with how good it had been looking going into this year.
Well, we would expect that at Watkins Glen they would not wad up too much equipment.
You would expect,
but then
you look back to, say, Brazil.
Well, that's true, but this is very different, though. You're not on a temporary street course with walls right on either side of you. This at Barber, if I recall, they got out of there unscathed from a crash damage standpoint. Mm-hmm. Sato had the fluky, I think that's where they had the throttle cable got swallowed by the engine somewhere. But from a natural course standpoint, from a permanent road course, you wouldn't expect too much damage. So it's probably good they have Watkins Glen coming up this week. They get another off week, but then they go back to Toronto. And a lot of people have broken equipment in Toronto.
Toronto is good for tearing up cars,
yes,
absolutely.
It is. So hopefully,
especially turn three.
Yes, especially turn three. So we hope that you know, they get a relatively cheap weekend coming up and then get to do well at Toronto. Now, that being said, their car that did finish with EJ Viso had a very strong run.
Absolutely.
Coming home third, and I was just waiting for something to go wrong for him. And that's terrible to say, but, you know, the people I was actually watching the race with, when one of them pointed out that, "Hey, look, Viso's in third, and I think this was 50 laps to go," I said, "Oh, don't worry, that situation will rectify itself." And to his credit, he drove a very smart race. I even asked him afterwards in the post-race conference. I said, "You know, with the luck you've been having this year, you've seen your two teammates already been taken out. What does that do to your mindset?" And to his credit, he said, "You know, at that point, it was more, okay, let's just finish the race. Let's bring the car home." And that's exactly what he needed to do. But the other two drivers need to start taking that mindset from the beginning. All three of them would be well served to start the race with the mindset, "Let's bring the car home in one piece."
Absolutely. And actually, that's an interesting quote, and it gives us an insight into EJ's mindset, because he does drive very strong races when he manages to keep the car off the wall. So if he's starting to think that way a little more, maybe we'll see some stronger results from him a little bit more consistently.
What you hope, though, is that if by wanting to, quote-unquote, bring the car home, that he doesn't lose all of that aggressiveness that made him fast over the last couple of years.
I don't think that we have to be too concerned about that. He's clearly got a driver personality that's got that aspect to it that I think it would be difficult to remove and still call him EJ Vizo.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true.
So let's look at one of the other major incidents from the weekend. And this one seems like it comes up an awful lot, but we had Milka again causing trouble. This one may not have been so much her fault. In fact, there's been some discussion of the fact that she may have actually done a rather spectacular job of saving the car, because it didn't appear to be the case in the TV and the net feeds at the time, but she apparently got into, power got into the side of her a little bit, and she wasn't prepared for it, and she did get up and into Marco's way, but in doing so, she kept the car going in a straight line after some contact between Power's tire and her side pod.
It was. I didn't realize that there was contact either until I had seen a highlight a little bit later on, and about the fourth lap after that first caution, right after she got lapped. There's clearly a tire mark on her side pod, so there was some contact there. I think it was at a pretty aggressive move on Will Power's part. That early in the race, you know, the green flag had come back out somewhere around the 9th or 10th lap, as I recall, 12 laps somewhere in there. And I think they lapped her the first time by lap 21 or something like that. So you're 21 laps into a 250-lap race. It's not exactly the time to go dive-bombing into Turn 3. She was obviously very slow. I mean, geez, she was lapped twice by the 31st lap. So obviously she was very far off the pace. Everyone could see that. I just don't think it was quite the time in the race to go making a move unless you're 110% sure that the move is there to be made. Now, that being said, she was all over the track. She was so slow during the race that, in fact, the next person ahead of her in the standings had lapped her by about lap 27. I think that was Bertrand Berghet, as I recall, one of the Conquest cars. So she was terrifyingly slow. She didn't look good at all out there. I was wondering why Brian Barnhart or Race Control waited almost 50 laps to park her. I think 56 was, I think, a number I heard about when she got parked.
Well, but they keep trying to give her chances to improve, which is, to their credit, noble. But, I mean, how many chances could she get? I realize. And I've spoken in defense of the fact that there's another aspect to this situation where some people say yes, some people say no, but it's impossible to not speculate that Citgo is paying for both of those cars in the Dale Coyne garage to be on the track right now. And on the one hand, yes, she's an embarrassment to the sport and she shouldn't be out there. But on the other hand, if you lose two cars and a team owner with great history in the sport, that doesn't look so good either.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, really, when you come to short track oval racing, traffic has always been a concern. And it doesn't concern me so much that she's slow, because you're always going to have slow drivers out there. The problem is that she appears to be spooked when she gets, when the other traffic is coming upon her. She isn't able to hold a stable racing line, and she isn't able to hold a stable and safe racing speed. And that's where the concern. It's one thing to be 10 miles off the race pace, but if you're 10 miles off the race pace, you can't hold a consistent line, and when the leaders lap, you drop to 25 miles off the race pace. That's a huge problem. I think the drivers after this weekend, I wouldn't be surprised to see some of the other drivers start to voice a little bit more concern, just because, I mean, this is obviously a safety hazard. We saw what happens with when you have vastly different paced vehicles at Indianapolis when we had the incident at the end. Now, that was a little bit different, where it was a very sudden change of velocity with Ryan Hunter-Reay, where Milka is flat out, she's just slow. But the way she was all over the track this weekend, it looked dangerous and scary out there.
And that's interesting because, generally speaking, Milka's reputation on ovals has been that, yes, she's slow, yes, she's way off the pace, but at least she doesn't tend to get in anyone's way. And she does manage to generally keep it in a line and be out of the way when it comes time to be lapped, and that's sort of why they've let her stick around in that context as long as they have. If that's changing, or if that is just an aspect of short track racing that she's not used to and hasn't got enough practice in, hard to say. At any rate, I'm glad that it's not my decision to have to tell her that she can't race, as opposed to, you know, do you keep the car in, keep the car counts up, keep Dale Coyne on the track, because I don't know what the answer to that is. I'm not sure anyone does.
And to be fair, Milka was not the only one that was slow. You know, she was probably the slowest, but there were a lot of times where lap traffic caused big trouble. Marco Andretti, later in the race, after he had some handling issues, but the second half of that race, he was painfully slow. I mean, he was getting lapped every 15, 20 laps almost, and there were a couple of times where the leaders caught him very quickly and had to check up.
Hideki was having pretty heavy problems at the beginning, too.
Yes, Hideki Muto was extremely slow. They had problems. I don't know they had necessarily had problems getting around him, but he certainly jumbled up some standings when they came to pass him, and the leaders just hit him at the wrong time. Simona Di Silvestro had some major handling issues, and how she didn't crash 3, 4, 5 times, I have no idea. There were at least 2 times when I looked up and she was pointing almost straight at the wall. One time coming off of 2 and one time coming off of 4.
But here's the key difference. Hideki and Newman Haas made the decision to park it based on their handling issues. Simona Di Silvestro and HVM made the decision to park it because they can't afford to lose another tub, but that's another discussion. Milka has to be parked.
That is true.
She has to be told, and there's something wrong with that because it happens every single time now, every single weekend.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree. That is something that is concerning, why there isn't that respect, isn't the right word, but that level of concern and courtesy toward their fellow drivers, why they need to be pulled off the track when it's so blatantly obvious how slow she was. It is a concern. Hopefully the road courses, I don't know. I don't even go there.
She's worse at the road courses.
Every time we
Ohio last year, it was terrible.
Every time we change circuit types, I keep saying, oh, okay, now that we're on the ovals, maybe it'll be a little better. Now that we're on the street courses, maybe it'll be a little better. So maybe I just give up. It's not going to get better.
No.
I don't know really how else to dissect it. It's just not getting better, and I don't see it ever getting better. Some people just aren't meant to drive at this level.
Well, we can talk about somebody who is meant to drive at this level, and that is Tony Kanaan. What a fantastic race for him this weekend, and it's so great to see him on top again.
Not only that, Tony Kanaan's drive, and before we get really into Tony, and let's talk about Tony and EJ Viso, both of them started way kind of back in the pack. I think Tony started 15th, and EJ maybe 18th, I guess, and they drove up there. They didn't get there by pit strategy. They didn't get there by pitting off sequence. They didn't, they drove and passed 13, 14 cars to get to their position.
Mm-hmm.
That was what was incredible about Iowa, is that you could do that.
And isn't it sad that we find that so wondrous?
Some days, yes. Iowa wasn't the track where spending $100,000 pays off to save 0.02 of a second. And that was the great thing about it. And that's what you get about short tracks that you don't get at the mile and a halfers. But yes, Tony Kanaan, fantastic story. I don't know anybody who was upset or disappointed in the slightest that he won. Even Elio, everyone wants to win. But Elio, you could just kind of tell that after the race, he wasn't as crushed as if he would have been beaten by Dario or Scott Dixon. Certainly, you could tell that there were... Even when they were doing the podium celebration with Tony and Elio and EJ, there was you could tell there was so much love and admiration between TK and Elio. And there's been a lot of talk over the last few years that relationship has been strained. And, anytime you have two people that have been friends for as long as those two have, you have your ups and you have your downs. They've had some down times, but you could just tell those two sitting or standing next to each other in victory lane just how genuinely happy they were and the respect that they have for each other. I actually kind of felt a little bit bad for EJ Viso. He just really looked like a third wheel there, where Tony and Elio were, you know, had their arm around each other, and then there's EJ just standing by himself. I felt bad for EJ with that. But
I can't help but feel that the few times that we have seen TK and Elio get into scraps over the years, it's a little bit like fighting brothers, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's that sort of sibling-type arguments where they get it out of their systems and then they go back to being as close as they ever were. That's the sort of relationship that they seem to have.
Right. There was a couple of years ago, I forget, was it after the 2006 or 2007 season, where one of the last races of the year, that frustration, I think it went through the offseason and even started the next year. They were still talking about it. But, you know, by and large, those two, like you say, that's exactly how I would have said it. It's a brotherly relationship where they fight, they get it over with, and, you know, at the end of the day, they're still very, very close friends.
Well, we had the good fortune of speaking with Tony Kanaan today, and we'll get to playing that interview at the end of the podcast. But for the time being, let's move on and discuss the next race. We're heading into the next road course stint of the season now, and we will be next weekend, not this coming weekend, the following, back at Watkins Glen, New York, for the Camping World Grand Prix. I will be at this one, and I'm very much looking forward to it, especially given the news that came out today where we had both Paul Tracy and Ryan Hunter-Reay confirmed as being part of the field. Paul Tracy will be racing with Dreyer and Reinbold, replacing Mike Conway in number 24. I think his sponsors off the top of my head were Honda Indy Toronto, which is a nice little promotional piece for them ahead of the Toronto race, and
Motegi Wheels?
That's right.
Motegi Racing, yeah. A wheel company, I guess it is. I'm not familiar with the company, actually.
And we don't know yet what the sponsorship situation is with Ryan Hunter-Reay. He doesn't even himself seem to know the details based on his tweets from earlier today. But we do know that we'll see him there, which makes Andretti Autosport a five-car operation for the Glen, because Adam Carroll's stint with the team begins this weekend for the contract that he's signed with the team earlier this year. So we'll see them running five cars at the Glen.
Yeah, and I don't know much about Adam. I think there are a lot of our listeners that do. My understanding is he's coming from the A1GP ranks.
Yes, he won a number of races for Team Ireland in A1GP, actually. I'm showing here from the 2008-09 season, he had five wins. That's not too shabby at all.
Oh.
So it'll be interesting to see how he performs in his IndyCar debut.
I would expect that from coming from his pedigree and with an Andretti Autosport ride, I think that he'll probably, I would expect the top half of the field with him. I think that would be a realistic expectation for him.
Well, we shall see.
So the other interesting thing, though, with Paul Tracy driving the number 24 sponsored by the Honda Indy Toronto and this other Motegi Racing, is where does the Dad Root Beer sponsorship go this weekend? Does
that's a good question.
Does Graham Rahal still have life left in him for that ride? Or
there have been rumors swirling that they're planning to be a three-car team for that weekend.
Well, that would be where the third car is coming from then.
But why would they put PT in the 24 and then dust off the 23 and put the Dad sponsorship on that?
There's That's why I was surprised by the announcement that he was going to be in the 24. Unless they really wanted to get this out there as Paul being the replacement for Mike Conway this week. But I'm sure that Dad sponsorship is still out there somewhere. So
well, you know what, though? This could have been one of those weekends because Conway's sponsorship flips back and forth between Dad's and Roll Coder. And perhaps Roll Coder wanted to take a back seat without Mike in the seat.
Could be. But it is surprising, though, that this that whatever sponsorship package was on the 24, had Conway been in that ride, that it has suddenly not been accounted for. So whether that is through Roll Coder or the Dads or the Hot Wheels or whatever else is on that car. And we didn't see Z-Line last week at Iowa. He would, Justin Wilson had the charter sponsorship. So they are doing this kind of sponsorship dance right now.
But it really would be great to see a third car, especially if Graham wants to pilot, or obviously he wants to pilot it, if Graham is allowed to pilot that car this weekend at Watkins Glen.
Something else to look for possibly with the Glen this weekend is that some very slight changes were made to the track in the off season, if I remember correctly. I know they made a number of safety enhancements. I can't remember precisely where on the track those were or to what extent they were. I know they either added or deepened some of the sand traps, and they added a number of safer barriers in a few spots. So before I go down there, I'll have to take a look at that in more detail and keep an eye out for how that might change the event this year over previous years. Other than that, what do we expect to see at the Glen, Paul?
Well, based on past history, you have to assume that Scott Dixon is going to run strong again. He won this race, what, 3 out of the first 4 years? 4 out of 5, something? No, he won the first three in a row, and then we had Ryan Hunter-Reay and Justin Wilson last 2. But I would expect him to be very strong again. Dario, you always have, both of the Chip Ganassi guys you have to assume are going to be strong. I would expect Ryan Hunter-Reay again to run very strong at Andretti Autosport.
Certainly, I like to believe that we might see another dark horse come up out of the ranks and show some stuff this weekend. This seems to be a track that's very forgiving for that as opposed to some of the others, and it would be great to get another new name on the top of the podium this weekend, although we've been pretty good with that this year as opposed to last season in particular. Not so much with the team shakeups, but I think we've had, 7 of 8 races have had a different winner or something.
Well,
like
you
look
at the different winners. Both of the Ganassi guys have won. We've had Power and Castro Neves and Briscoe.
And Briscoe.
So we got those 5.
And now TK and Ryan Hunter-Reay.
And TK. So that's 7 different winners in 8 races.
So that, yeah, it would be great to add another one to that list. I'm not sure off the top of my head who it might be.
I would not be at all surprised to see Takuma Sato run extremely well this weekend and maybe even pull out a victory.
It would certainly help his Rookie of the Year standings.
It would certainly help. this is obviously the coming from a natural road course, something that he's very pedigreed in. He'll be a little bit more familiar with those. You know, Justin Wilson at Dry Run Reinbold, obviously the defending champion from his days last year with Dale Coyne. Won't be at all surprised to see him run well there this weekend.
No, and people might be quick to question whether the DNR cars would be strong enough on a road course. We know that their oval car is not bad, but we can look back to Sonoma last year with Mike Conway having placed on the podium in that race to speculate that their road course cars might be a little stronger than we might think, and that is not an outside possibility. But when you look at that, and you look at the fact that PT is going to be in one of those same cars, some possibility for speculation there as well. Wouldn't it be interesting to see PT climb into a car in a one-off and finish at the top of the podium?
Well, we saw him do it 2 years ago at Edmonton when he drove for Vision Racing. Came in the middle of the year, and I think he finished 4th that race, 3rd or 4th, in a one-off. So he certainly is able to do it. He drove the Glen last year. So he's at least familiar with the track.
Last year was his first year at the Glen, though. That was his first time ever.
Correct, right. Mm-hmm. So I won't be at all surprised to see him do very well. So it's going to be a very interesting weekend to see how everything unfolds there. And I would not be at all surprised to see us have a non-quote-unquote red and white driver win this race. I won't be surprised at all.
Another one that just popped into my head is Alex Tagliani and the FAS team heading back into the road course section of the season. I know that their performance hasn't been as strong in the ovals as they would have liked, but they sure did look good in those first 4 races. So we may see them power their way back to the front again.
The thing with the FAS is that they've been practicing and qualifying well, but they haven't been able to bring the car home, you know, when they run FAS. I think those first 4 races, they ran very well each one, but I don't think they finished inside the top 10 in any of them, did they?
I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I don't think that was very often Alex's fault.
Brazil, they finished 19th after that accident. They did have a 6th place finish at St. Pete. Then they had a 10th at Barber and a 21st at Long Beach.
You make a good point, though, that and I'm going to take this and turn it around, though, in that their finishes haven't been spectacular, but it's not for lack of performance on the track. And their qualifying performances have been spectacular, especially given that they're a new team. So I think the best is yet to come for FASD, and it's going to start again at the Glen, I believe, and continue right through to Sonoma.
I think there are every bit of a dozen cars that could win this weekend, and I would not be blown away.
And maybe we'll get even luckier, and it'll be one of the ones that does blow us away that wins it.
Yeah, if Mario Romancini wins this race, I would be blown away. If, you know, if Alex Lloyd wins this race, I would be shocked.
Yeah, people said the same thing about Justin Wilson last year.
It is true. That is true. But, you know, let's be fair. Alex Lloyd, I like him, but he's not Justin Wilson.
No.
So I would be shocked at one of those two. If Simona wins this weekend, I would be shocked. If Danica won this weekend, I would be shocked.
Wow.
But there aren't too many more that I would say I would just be blown away if they won. So I think it's going to be a hell of a race. Next weekend, not this weekend, but next weekend.
Yes, looking forward to it for sure. And I, as I mentioned, I'll be there and I'll be reporting on the ground as usual with the daily blog posts as well as tweets as much as the track will let me. Having not been there, I don't know what the cell reception is like, but I'll do everything that I can to keep you informed.
I'm going to guess looking at the map, there may not be real heavy cell coverage there.
Moving on, the hot topic of the moment seems to be the 2011 schedule. I posted my thoughts in a rather lengthy blog entry earlier this week. I've already had some revisions to it, some changes of opinion or changes in information based on some more tidbits that have come out here and there. And that's the beautiful thing about the schedule time of year is that it's in constant flux, and keeping on top of it is always a fun challenge. You had some thoughts based on that post and some other stories that you wanted to share, Paul. So let's start there.
Well, I think one of the things we really need to watch that's really going to affect everything is how this relationship between the Indy Racing League and ISC works itself out. Right now, ISC runs four tracks that are on the Izod IndyCar Series schedule. The race we'll have next weekend at Watkins Glen, the Oval at Chicago, the Oval at Miami, and the Oval at Kansas. The Oval at Homestead, that track has been on the chopping block for at least the last couple of years. Last year was their first year they were moved to the end of the season where they had traditionally started the season. And I think people wanted to say, okay, we'll give them 2 years there. But it's usually not a very good race, or at least not a good race from the standpoint of being a lot of action. A lot of strategy, but not a lot of action. The Kansas race has just been terrible the last several years. Not a lot of action or strategy. The one at Watkins Glen, people are wondering how stable it is because it keeps moving from date to date, and they're trying to find how to make that situation work, come up with a stable date, and still be a profitable event for the track. To me, the only one that really seems safe is Chicago. And Chicago's problem is that this is the first year that the IndyCar weekend has not been sold as a group package with the NASCAR weekend that's actually coming up here in a couple weeks at the track. We saw the attendance at Kansas way, way, way down this year when those two tickets were separated. So I'm not going to be at all surprised to see Chicago attendance down as well. I don't think Chicago I don't think there's a concern about Chicago not being on the 2011, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if this time next year we're talking about will it make the 2012 season.
There's really no excuse for Chicago not doing well, though, and that does come back to the ISC issue, where the general accusation is that ISC is just not promoting IndyCar events to the extent that they're promoting NASCAR events, which, of course, relates back to the fact that ISC is more or less run by NASCAR.
Right.
Chicago is a huge market, and it's not a terribly difficult track to reach from the greater Chicago area.
No, not at all. Nope.
There's no good reason for it not to be at least half full all the time. And yet, my first experience with Chicago was last year, and somebody in one of the comments to the post earlier this week made a good point in that it has mostly been people who have just kind of accidentally landed on NASCAR fans' IndyCar tickets that they didn't want and show up just to drink beer and not really have anything else to do that weekend that are the kind of people that we're getting, and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, Chicago's a big city. We're now marketing more towards these urban sort of environments where I would expect that this year we're going to see the big Izod party, the Hugo Boss party, that sort of thing going on in the city, the same way that things were going on for Long Beach. And there's just no good explanation other than the fact that the event is not being promoted to the extent that it should be. And yet I'm right now looking at an article from today's Star Gazette, from stargazette.com, where there are two interesting quotes from Terry Angstad, one where he says that their relationship with ISC is positive, and the other, which is, it's a quote related to Watkins Glen specifically, and that they're trying to maintain that race for next year. But he says, we had a very positive conference call with the ISC folks. To me, that doesn't sound like the strained relationship that everybody wants to make the relationship between IndyCar and ISC out to be. Plus, two of the tracks that Randy Bernard has mentioned as being on his wish list are ISC tracks. And so if those were to come in, or the fact that he's looking to bring those in also tends to suggest that the supposed rift between ISC doesn't really exist. But should it?
Well, there's no doubt that the level of promotion from ISC has not been up to snuff the last many years.
Now, how much of that, though, is the central body of ISC, and how much of it is at the track level?
Well, I think the track level is the one that's actually the one that is in charge of promoting their own event. But, you know, we saw at Michigan that there was just nothing done to promote that event, really.
There can't be an edict coming down from upon high from ISC saying to these tracks, don't bother to promote these IndyCar events, can there?
No, I don't see that. But I see that the financial models behind these, if they have to spend a dollar to gain one more seat at a NASCAR event, that NASCAR event will probably return them $2 in revenue, where that same dollar spent on an IndyCar event may or may not get them their dollar back. It may get them $1.25. And therein lies the issue, is that these tracks are no longer selling out their NASCAR events, and all of their promotional efforts are now going toward the NASCAR events. The Chicago is the perfect example. I mean, they are blank. You look at Chicagoland Speedway's, either their Twitter account or their Facebook account, it is 99-1, the number of NASCAR-related items they post versus the number of IndyCar-related posts. It may even be worse than that, because I don't know that I've ever even seen an IndyCar mention out of them. You look at their TV advertisements in the area, they're all NASCAR. If you're lucky, they may show Danica Patrick climbing out of an IndyCar. Other than that, it's just NASCAR, NASCAR, NASCAR. Their radio spots, they're all NASCAR.
But it's a paradox, because if you don't put the money into promoting the events, you can't expect to see any return.
No,
you can work with an upward spiral or a downward spiral, and everybody just seems to be letting the downward spiral spin away right now. You have to invest to see return. That's just basic economics. So if they're not willing to put any money and any effort into initially getting $1.25 back for their dollar, and in 1 to 5 years maybe getting $1.50, $1.75, $2 eventually after the groundwork is laid.
What just drives me nuts is that there's nobody that anybody that's going to go to the NASCAR race in Chicago already knows it's there. So this effort that they put in to sell more tickets to Chicago for the NASCAR race, how effective is that really becoming? You're trying to sell things to the people that already know it's there. The IndyCar event isn't nearly as well known about because it hasn't had the coverage. You're trying to market and tell people about an event that already know the event is there when you start talking about the NASCAR side. From the IndyCar side, I don't understand why they're not putting that effort, and I think this is what you're just saying, put that effort to reach a new group of people that don't even know the product exists at this point. And that's the frustrating thing, and it seems to be consistent across all the ISC tracks. I hear the same thing from people that live in Kansas City when it came to the Kansas track. You hear the same thing, basically, from the folks in Miami. You know, in any of these, Michigan, you heard the same thing about that. They blanket all of their coverage with NASCAR, and IndyCar was almost non-existent.
I think that it's possible to get a lot deeper into this topic than we probably really have time for in one podcast, because there's a whole mentality to this that needs to be looked at in terms of the fact that for a long time people didn't see the IRL or Champ Car or Open Wheel on this continent in general as being worthy of bothering to promote because it seemed to be on its way out, or so the NASCAR pundits would have had us think, and that in a way IndyCar is battling back against that mentality when they're trying to work to get the promotion and the attention for these things. But it is telling that the ISC tracks in particular seem to be the consistently the ones where they have the most problems pulling people in. So we'll have to just see how that goes in terms of the way that the schedule plays out.
Well, look at what happens at Texas, though. I mean, they have two NASCAR events at Texas, and they can still pull 80,000 people at an IndyCar event. They still promote the IndyCar event.
Eddie Gossage is probably one of the premier racing promoters on this continent.
If not the most premier, at least in the United States.
I don't know what the answer is. Some people think that IndyCar is worth promoting and some people don't. And I guess it's a matter of convincing the people who don't that it is worth their money and time. That is the difficult task that Randy Bernard and his marketing group have ahead of them at this point.
Well, if you're not going to promote it and put your effort behind it, why have the event in the first place? Is this kind of like the poor kid that has the birthday party and his mom says, hey, you have to invite Joey down the street? You know, I don't want Joey, but all right.
Yeah, but at the same time, Paul, if we kept look at the trends over the years, if we kept ditching every track that wasn't doing a sufficient job of promoting the race, would we have any oval tracks left?
No, I'm not saying that we shouldn't go there. I'm just saying if you're going to have an event, why?
Right, but the immediate backlash to that can be, well, then why bother having the event at all? Okay, see you, IndyCar.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Right, from an ISC.
It's a very delicate dance.
Right, from an ISC or from a Kansas Speedway standpoint, what benefit is it to them to have an event if they're not going to promote it?
Well, they must be making at least a little bit of a profit, or they wouldn't bother.
They must.
So I guess they put exactly as much effort into it as they need to pull in some kind of profit and cover their expenses, and that's as much as they are interested in doing.
It'd be curious if, and you know, you'll never hear this come out of ISC or from NASCAR, but how much is it that ISC is playing nice so that NASCAR can continue to go to Indianapolis?
That's a good question.
And if it comes to the point where, let's say the Brickyard 400 draws 150,000 this year, and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Jeff Belzkus says, you know what, it's not worth me opening my facility for 125,000, 150,000 people. What happens to that relationship then?
That's a very good question. Won't happen, but it's interesting to speculate.
Well, if attendance keeps declining like it has been, now it will be interesting this year to see what for the first time IMS is offering general admission seating for the 400. They've never done that before. So the grandstands may even look more empty than before, because I think we're really seeing a lot of people move out of the grandstands into the infield, both from the 500, and I think you'll see even more of it in the 400. But you know, from a sponsor standpoint, it's a little bit tougher to sell sponsorship, both from a TV standpoint and at the track, I think, if it looks like the stands are mostly empty or large percentage empty.
Well, let's talk about the changes that are coming to the 2011 schedule that we do know. We've got Baltimore in the first weekend of August, the first full weekend of August, which has traditionally been Mid-Ohio's date. But we have heard confirmation from the series that Mid-Ohio will be on the schedule next year, and that weekend is going to be shifted, which way will be interesting to see. I would tend to think, as I said in my post, that it'll go deeper into August, because there seems to be a little bit more room there. There are a lot of events that have established traditional July dates that I think we'll need to maintain those. Plus, we have the fact that New Hampshire is reportedly going to be on the weekend of July 30th and 31st.
Mid-Ohio is not going anywhere.
No, we know that. There's that relationship with Honda will keep it steady as long as the relationship with Honda exists.
Well, that's the other thing. Let's talk about that real quick before we go too far away. Because right now, both Mid-Ohio and Motegi are events that we hear so much about. We go there because Honda really likes us to be there. Well, once Honda isn't the exclusive manufacturer anymore for the...
You can't say once. We may very well find it may still be.
That's true. if Honda is no longer the exclusive engine supplier, how long do these because Honda wants us to events continue to exist? Does anybody really want to go to Motegi if Honda doesn't say, you know, we'd really like you to race here?
Motegi, to me, is a no-brainer to ditch once, there's that once again, if we find that we no longer need to make Honda happy. Mid-Ohio is a little bit more of a question because it's actually quite a successful event. It's a great location. It draws in a lot of people from all over the place. It's got a huge radius of people that come in. I drive down there. It's a seven-hour drive. It can bring people in from Indy and even further on that side. People come up from Pennsylvania. I've heard of people driving up from as far away as Georgia, and this they see as kind of being their event. Because it's a great camping track. You don't have to just have a motorhome to camp there. There's tent camping as well. And, of course, it's a doubleheader with the ALMS, which makes it a weekend that's packed pretty much from top to bottom with racing action. So it's been quite successful. And as much as I would love to be able to say, oh, well, you know, if we don't need to please Honda anymore, let's shut the door on Mid-Ohio and go back to Cleveland because we all know how much I adore Cleveland, but I just don't know if it's that easy with Mid-Ohio. There's a lot of good reasons. Even though the IndyCar race hasn't exactly been a barn burner for the last few years, there are a lot of good reasons. I feel as though there may have been races way back in the 90s that were pretty good.
The only exciting thing ever happened at Mid-Ohio was when Michael Andretti went tumbling down into turn 5, or whatever turn that was at the end of the back straight there. That was the most exciting thing that ever happened at Mid-Ohio.
I don't remember having as much against Mid-Ohio in the 90s as I do now. My memory is a little bit more faded, I have to be honest. I haven't watched any of those in a long time. But this is one of those cases where I'm not sure that the fact that it's not the most exciting IndyCar racing venue in the world is enough reason to justify kicking it off the schedule. I know it's a terrible reason to keep a race, but money plays a big factor in this sport. And it seems to... For a lot, it's got people streaming through the door, so it's hard to look at that and say, oh, the TV audience isn't getting the best show here, so forget these hundreds of thousands of dollars that we're pulling in, let's just shut it down. That's not good for anybody's pocketbook.
No, I'll give you that. So we know Baltimore is the weekend of August 5th through 7th.
Yep.
That'll be preceded by New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, which is a great addition. Yeah. Don't know a single person that's not excited about that. It's not official yet. That's to be announced next weekend at the NASCAR race, I believe.
Yeah, it will be, which will be really interesting.
Yeah.
I bet the news will not make the NASCAR press. I bet they will not cover significantly Dario Franchitti running demonstration laps before the race. Just a hunch.
We're also hearing from here and there, again, nothing official, but the people in Brazil are apparently expecting their race to run on May 1st as the lead-in to the month of May. Reasons for that being that Carnival is a bit later next year, and they would need a bit more time to prepare the track for the IndyCars. Some people have speculated that although that is getting pretty close to the Brazilian winter, the weather might be a little bit more palatable as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. Seems to be generally positive reaction to the concept of starting the season back in the U.S., though. And it's hard to question that. It would be great to see the season start in somewhere where they could really make a big impact and a big splash on the North American fans. St. Pete may be that place. Should be that place. It's a great race. It's a great venue. Feels like it should be doing a little bit better than it is, but it's not doing terribly. And, I mean, who doesn't love being in Florida in nice beach weather at the end of March, so...
Be nice if that was a little earlier. I hate to wait till the end of March, though, to start the season.
It does seem difficult, especially given that NASCAR starts so very, very much earlier than that. But at the same time, with only 17, possibly we're hearing 18 races on the schedule and not wanting to have too many two or even, God forbid, 3-week gaps in the schedule throughout the season, you have to have some give somewhere.
Yeah, that's just, I think that's too late.
It is, but until we got the health of the series back up to the point where we can see 2022, dare I say even 2024 event seasons, I just don't see how they can stretch things out enough to let us start earlier without having us end too early and miss the end of the summer season.
Right.
It would be great, though, to see that someday. I think we can all hope for that. Well, I think that covers everything that you and I need to discuss this week, Paul.
We'll go into the schedule a little more at a later date. But
yes, as things continue to unfold.
The big news coming up probably as early as next Tuesday or Wednesday, we may be hearing, finally, the chassis decision.
Well, that's when they're meant to have the chassis decision prepared. I don't think we're going to hear about it right away.
Right. It would be nice if we did, but
I think 1 to 2 weeks is the last time period I heard. Yep. It may have changed since then, but
I think we'll know by Toronto.
That would be super.
And I have not heard. I'll be interested how this actually will get disseminated, whether they'll have a large press conference, whether it'll just be a release. It'll be interesting to see how, because obviously this is a extremely monumental decision, so I'm very interested to see how this is going to play out.
Well, and without further ado, as promised, Paul and I earlier today had the opportunity to speak with Tony Kanaan about his win at Iowa and get his thoughts on how the past season or so has gone for him and some interesting insights into the teammate dynamics at Andretti Autosport as well. So let's let you listen in on that now. Well, let's start on the most positive note possible. Things are finally looking up for you, TK. Last season was so challenging for you from top to bottom, and this year didn't start out a whole lot better either, but now this past weekend we finally got to see you back in victory lane. You must feel like a huge weight has been lifted from your shoulders.
No, for sure. I think, you know, this year it didn't look like it. It hadn't started the way we wanted it, but we were really competitive. We just hadn't been able to finish the races that that we wanted it. But definitely a good result, I think. Long time overdue, and we need to carry this momentum up to the season.
And you've talked about some of the emotions that came along with that win, with it coming on Father's Day being significant for you, with your first time with your son being old enough to appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as they grow up, they understand it a lot more. Now he knows what it is. He asked me about the trophy, and he wanted to see it, and it was really special, and I think it could, if I had to wait and choose, I think it came about at the right time.
That's fantastic. And you also mentioned that it was sort of nostalgic for you this weekend after having gotten to race Elio, and it sort of reminded you of racing him in karts back in Brazil. Did you have any memories related to that you could share with us?
Well, obviously, we race against each other all our lives, so it's not like a one special one because we've been around each other for so long. But it was just nice to be able to be back in the front. I mean, it wasn't just Ed, it was with Dario as well, and just battling for the lead and having a dominant car, for sure. It just brought me back memories back in the days that we were, 8 and 9 years old, racing against each other back in Brazil.
A lot of the drivers were commenting on the bump at Iowa having caused them problems. It doesn't seem to have been too much of a problem for you. What were your experiences with it through the weekend?
Definitely, I got caught there 3 years in a row, so I should be not liking it. But I think it's a characteristic of the track, and there is nothing we could do about it that week. And if they're going to fix that for next year or not, I don't know. But, I mean, I can say that obviously I had to work with my race car to be able to go around that bump. So, for sure, it's a characteristic of the track.
One last question about Iowa. A lot is being made about your comments in Victory Lane about you thinking you're quote-unquote two teammates, meaning Marco and Ryan. Was that just a slip of words on your part that's being misinterpreted by the public, or is there really more to it than that?
No, there is nothing to it. I mean, what I did only thank those two because I guess Danica was busy at that time, and they came to actually comfort me because I was really disappointed after my qualifying, and people just tried to make a big deal out of nothing, and there is, it wasn't like me trying to leave her out or anything like that. It was just a really, only those two guys came to see me, so I had to thank those two.
Tony, on that note, you say that they came to see you and kind of talked to you through things, but really you've been racing since these guys were in diapers, if not before they were born. What types of things can your younger teammates really talk to you about or teach you in these situations, where usually it's the other way, it's you comforting or teaching them something?
Yeah, actually, it was the first time that happened, and I felt good. I mean, sometimes it doesn't matter how long you've been around and how long you learn. You're always learning, and I was kicking myself because I made a little mistake in qualifying that cost me a lot of lap time, and they came up just to say, man, you know, you still have a good car, and things that I knew, but sometimes it's good to hear. It doesn't matter. I think, you know, it doesn't matter how old or young you are. You always, advice is always good, especially when it comes from some of your teammates. So definitely I was surprised, and then I was really thrilled with what happened, for sure.
Well, speaking of learning things, let's take a look back real quick to probably one of your biggest learning moments last month at Indianapolis. Obviously, a huge emotional roller coaster from you. What was it like from your perspective? What did you learn about yourself going through that whole experience?
Well, I think one thing I've learned, like you just said, being around for so long, you think you went through everything in your career, and I definitely learned that I haven't. I've learned that the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is always going to teach you something. And other than that, I think it made us as a team much stronger. I mean, we kept it together. We had every single reason to actually have a nervous breakdown and actually deteriorate the relationship that we have in the team, and we didn't. And we kept it together. We kept believing in each other. It just made ourselves stronger. I mean, that was a definitely, you know, people look at it as a very hard month, and then I see it was probably one of the most positive ones I've ever had.
You talked a little bit at that time, especially on bump day, about what a huge effect the crowd's reaction had on you and your mentality. Can you give us a little bit of insight on what it was like to be in your position, to feel so much support coming at you from the stands? And, I mean, from the fans' perspective, we all know that support is out there for you, but there are these moments where maybe it becomes even more real to you and more, as the individual, as the driver, more tangible, and that must have been one of them.
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, I don't know if I'll be able to describe to you guys how good that felt. But I knew, obviously, I was always a very popular driver during the month of May and in Indianapolis and then during the, you know, through the whole season. But, I mean, the way I got the response from the fans, every time I went out on the racetrack, they're clapping, screaming my name and giving me strength to continue. And that's... it's pretty amazing. It's pretty remarkable when you have a chance to feel that way. After the race, I get out of the car, the whole crowd was standing up. It looked like I had won the race. So to be honest, I was thrilled. I was really touched. I'm not the kind of guy that gets emotion very often. And, they made me cry a couple times. You know, it's just, it's great to see. Sometimes we don't have the chance to interact with the fans when we're in the race car. You know, we do autograph sessions. I actually try to spend as much time as I can with them. But this time it was awesome. I think it's a moment that I will never forget.
Now, speaking of Andretti Autosport as a whole, there's been a lot of speculation. A lot of people have wanted to say that you guys aren't really to be considered one of the powerhouse teams in the series anymore. In the off season, there were a lot of administrative changes. Michael took sole ownership. Tom Anderson came in, some shuffling between teams. Do you think these changes have made a difference in the success that we're seeing now with Andretti Autosport? And do you think now that you guys are really, from an organizational standpoint, ready to be real challenges to the Penske and Ganassi juggernaut?
I mean, we're coming back. I mean, obviously, you know, when you set the standards so high, people are always going to talk about it. And, you know, we're just working really hard, Michael. And like you said, with the addition of Tom Anderson and some of the guys, it's been a huge help. And you know, for now, you know, I think people can say whatever they want, but we're working really hard. And I think it's been really positive what we got. And we, you know, how can I say, I believe that we're working towards to be up there with the Penske and the Ganassi. Do I think we need to improve a little bit more? For sure. But that's it's always going to be the case. So I'm not really concerned. I just think we've got to keep doing what we're doing, and then we can move forward.
Tony, one more question here. You kind of have a unique spot or got a unique perspective of what happened to Danica Patrick last month and some of the crowd reaction when she kind of wore her emotions on her sleeves. One of the things a lot of fans say is that a lot of the drivers in the Izod IndyCar series are too sterile with their emotions, that they don't come across as real people. Do you think that the driver saw that reaction to Danica and maybe that kind of justifies their conservative nature with the media, with fans a little bit?
No, I totally disagree. I think the way she did it, she was trying to blame in somebody else. And, you know, as a race car driver, you can't do that. If you win, you win, you're a good driver. If you don't, you blame your team. I mean, that team is the same team that has won the first race for her in her career and the only one that she did. And I think there are ways to come across. There is nothing wrong to show your emotions, but you don't owe any explanation to anybody. And to get out of the car and throw down your guys that have been working there for a whole month, you're driving the car. You're part of it. So it's not one person's fault. It's everybody's fault. And I think, you know, I've done it plenty of times and said it, guys, we didn't get it right this time, all of us. And then you admit that, and you don't try to come out. And that just came out really wrong, in my opinion. And I think it's not about not showing your emotions, but we race for teams, and we are sponsored by big companies, and we have an image to create. And sometimes emotions can hurt you a lot, which I think she can tell you that big time. And when you let the emotions lead, that's when you have a problem. So I think there's nothing wrong to be vocal about things, but you can. That wasn't an emotion. I mean, if I can call it the right emotion. I mean, that was blaming somebody else for something that you're not capable of doing it at the time.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time, and best of luck to you and the entire Andretti Autosport team as you head into the next road course stint of the season.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of our listeners at home for tuning in as well. As always, planetirl.com is your source online for podcasts, blog posts, photos, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar Series and beyond.